Dr. Joy Starr. I'm not sure where we were cut off just now, but technology does sometimes reign supreme. Today we're featuring the distinguished Lawrence Velvel, Dean of the Massachusetts School of Law at Andover, on the Madoff scandal. The Dean is an honors graduate of the University of Michigan Law School. He served as a government lawyer, a lawyer in private practice, and a law professor. He's the author of a book on the Vietnam War and civil disobedience, and of many law review and newspaper articles, including humor pieces written under a pseudonym. Dean Velvel has a fascinating perspective. Having lost money invested with Bernard Madoff, he contends the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, was willfully and horribly negligent in failing to monitor his operation. Welcome, Dean Velvel.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, well, how are you, and thank you for being with us today.
I'm fine, thank you very much, and let's hope my voice makes it through.
Okay, well, let's begin with the beginning. How did the Madoff situation arise in general, and specifically, how did you get involved?
Well, nobody knows for sure, at least nobody who knows is talking, about how the Madoff situation initially arose. Madoff went into business in 1960 or 1962. He began in 1962 to obtain money to invest through a couple of accountants, whom I imagine a lot of your listeners know of, fellows named Bienes and Avellino. By 1992, Madoff was managing, I believe it was $444 million. Most of the time, I gather, he was engaging in arbitrage and doing very well. It may have been legitimate at that time. Nobody really knows. But at some point, apparently in the 1980s, according to what little the government has said, the situation became crooked. And it was also about that time that, because of greater competition in arbitrage investments, Madoff switched his investment strategy, and he began using something that has come to be called the split strike conversion strategy, which I'll explain briefly in a moment. In 1992, the SEC somehow got wind of the fact that Bienes and Avellino, and I must say there were several others as well, as is already known and as is going to be pointed out, I gather, on a Frontline television program on May 12th, I think. There were many others, there were at least some others, maybe many others as well, who were collecting money for Madoff. But the SEC got wind of the fact that the Madoff was getting money from these two people, Bienes and Avellino. Actually, I suppose that initially the SEC didn't know where the money was going, but it knew Bienes and Avellino were raising money. And the SEC investigated the situation, determined that Bienes and Avellino were not registered as investment advisors and were selling what the SEC, I think rightly, considered under the law to be unregistered investment securities de facto. The SEC, after investigating, made Bienes and Avellino get out of the business. It determined during the course of the investigation that the investment manager they were using was Bernard Madoff. And although the SEC had feared a Ponzi scheme when it began the investigation, when it closed out the investigation, it made a public announcement. I think it was the assistant director of the New York Regional Office, a fellow named Cooperberg, made a public announcement that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, saying that there was no fraud in the connected with the Avellino and Bienes matter. And, of course, by then the SEC knew very well that the Madoff was the investment manager. I believe the SEC had spoken with Madoff I have heard, I don't know it for a fact, that the SEC had looked at his books. If so, obviously it looked at cooked books. And the SEC's announcement that there was no evidence of fraud appeared in the Wall Street Journal on December 1st, 1992. 15 days later, on December 16th, the Wall Street Journal published a long article saying that the investment manager had been Madoff. And I think it's probably fair to say that after that, it was sort of Katie bar the door, because the SEC's announcement, which securities lawyers tell us is never made by the SEC, never made by the SEC. It doesn't. It just doesn't make announcements that the situations involve no illegality. It just lets, if it has found no illegality, it just lets the situation die, so to speak. Except in very unusual situations where somebody has said that an investigation has played hob with his business, and in that case, the SEC will permit the individual, not the SEC, the individual, to say that no illegality was found. That at least is what securities lawyers uniformly tell us. But in this case, the SEC said that there was no evidence of fraud, and it was Katie bar the door, because people took that to mean there was an SEC imprimatur on the lawfulness and the non-fraudulent nature of what Madoff was doing. And that announcement was known to people for years into the future after it was made. I myself relied on it in 1995 when I got into Madoff for the first time. And I have had people write to me that they relied on that announcement even in as late as the early 2000s, 10 years afterward. It's a very powerful thing when the SEC says that a situation is clean. Anyhow,
if I can just ask you a question,
sure,
for a moment about that, going back to 1992, looking back now, how can you explain that the SEC would take that kind of proactive stance, knowing what you know today? What are your thoughts about it?
Well, I have speculations. That's all I hesitate to call them thoughts even. They are speculations. Right. They are perhaps informed speculations. They are probably speculations that a lot of people would agree with, but they are speculations. And here's what they are. One, somebody in the SEC was on the take. The fix was in. Two, Bernard Madoff was by then, and had by then been for many years, a leading figure in the securities industry. He had been president for 3 years. I think he was in the middle of his various presidencies of the National Association of NASDAQ, which is the organization created by the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers. He had been a leading figure, probably, it is fair to say, the leading figure in the creation of the electronic securities markets. He was an SEC consultant. The SEC relied on him from time to time. So it's possible that the SEC decided we're going to do good old Bernie a favor so that everybody will know that Bernie is not involved in anything untoward. Those are my two speculations. Either there was graft and bribery involved, or for some reason they decided to do good old Bernie a favor of the type that they have apparently never done for anybody else.
Why was Madoff made chairman of NASDAQ? What is it about his credentials that entitled him to such a position at the time?
Well, I've not really investigated that, but it seems to me fairly clear that the reason is that by the late 1980s, Madoff and his firm had become quite prestigious, because they had, as I say, created the electronic securities market, sometimes called the third market. The non-big board, non-New York Stock Exchange market. They had brought the Cincinnati Stock Exchange back to life, I understand, in order to facilitate this. And Madoff was just a tremendously big name by the late 1980s in the securities field.
So again, may I ask you, that being the case, and it obviously is the case, why would a man who was the genius behind all of that lay the foundation for the biggest Ponzi scheme in history? Is it possible that one glove fit with the other? That somehow what he was doing on the one hand fit with what he planned to do on the other?
Well, I think the answer to that question is yes. Let me go back to the first part of the question. Given all his success, why did Bernard Madoff do this? Well, number one, that's a question to which nobody yet knows the answer. Number two, there are those who think that his so-called legitimate business, his market-making business, when he would match buy orders and sell orders, was not an economically successful business, and that it was floated, although everybody thought it was a very successful business, and that it was instead floated by the money he made from his fraudulent Ponzi scheme. So those are two different ideas entirely, one that nobody knows, the other that his legitimate business was not really successful. And if there is some other reason, like perhaps he's just a sociopath, nobody really knows what the real reason is.
Well, sociopath, I always I feel uncomfortable with that word because it doesn't tell us anything. It, in this particular case, it suggests that the man set out to harm all of these people, and it's likely that he didn't really anticipate that he was going to be discovered, or perhaps he thought he'd bring it to an end before it would be discovered. I don't know. Do you feel comfortable with the word sociopath, or am I making an error here?
Perhaps you are in the Freudian field. I'm not. I don't care whether one calls him a sociopath, a psychopath, a liar, or a bum. You know, whatever the
situation is. Exactly. No, that's my point. I don't think that it matters what you call him. That's my point, yeah.
Well, all right. I agree with that. But people seem to understand it when you say that this person whom nobody really can understand must be psychopathic or sociopathic or call it what you will. In any event, he obviously didn't give a damn that he was going to, about the possibility that it was going to end up harming many, many people. Perhaps, he, as is said to be true of Ponzi schemes quite often, perhaps he thought this was just a temporary expedient for some purpose and that he'd be able to work his way out of it, which you have suggested. Perhaps not. I really don't know. All I can say is that nobody should be doing these kinds of things any more than somebody should be embezzling from a bank in order to cover debts on the theory that, well, I'll make the money back and I'll pay the bank back and nobody will be the wiser.
Okay, going back to the SEC, you've talked about their horrible negligence. Obviously, several years later, they were smelling a rat. They were warned time and time again about him. Can you give us further analysis on that?
Well, as I suppose everybody knows by now, a fellow named Harry Markopoulos, who was asked by his employer to replicate Madoff's great success and his strategy. Markopoulos is a mathematician. I mean, he's mathematically trained, among other things, and so he understood all the mathematics and the possibilities, arithmetic and mathematical possibilities of Madoff's split strike conversion strategy. And he said it took him about 5 minutes, that's the number he's used, 5 minutes, to figure out that it was impossible for Madoff mathematically to achieve the success that he did achieve. And so he began investigating the whole deal. He talked to a lot of people on Wall Street. He talked to people in feeder funds. He talked to people and Peter Funds abroad. He talked to other people mathematically trained. And then he began talking to the SEC in Boston and writing to the SEC explaining why Madoff either had to be doing something called front running, which I won't bother getting into, but it is illegal also, or in order to achieve such success, he either had to be front running or it was a Ponzi scheme. And, of course, it turns out to be a Ponzi scheme. He wrote to the SEC many times, probably, I guess, 5, 6, 8 times from 2000 on to 2008. The SEC investigated a couple of times, more times than not, it just blew him off, is my understanding. But a couple of times it investigated, it found nothing, finding nothing, it did nothing. And among the things that anybody can understand that the SEC ignored were, for example, Madoff's strategy involved buying options, both put options and call options. I haven't explained how the strategy worked, but suffice it to say here that for the strategy to work, you had to buy put and call options. I guess actually, technically speaking, you would sell a put option and you would buy a call option, but you had to engage in the options. Mark Coppola's pointed out that they're not to make a joke of it, but there are not enough options in the world to cover the purchasing of securities that Madoff claimed to be purchasing. And he told the SEC, check this for yourself. Call people on the Chicago Options Exchange, for example, and ask them if they've ever dealt with Madoff. And you're going to find out the answer is they will tell you no, they've never dealt with Madoff. Well, where is he getting these options? It's obvious he's not using the options. Talk to people who trade options on the street and ask them if they have ever been a counterparty to Madoff. You'll find that the answer is no. That was a very clear way of determining whether Madoff was doing what he claimed to be doing. And the answer, of course, was no. Madoff had, as we now know, a one-person accounting firm. There was David Freeling, the secretary and the retired person who started the firm. Whoever heard of a one-person accounting firm doing the auditing of a major Wall Street house? That was just crazy. Madoff was giving fund advisors 4% off the top when they brought money to him. Now, hedge fund managers normally take a commission off the top of 1%, I think it is, sometimes 2% of them, perhaps, and something like 20% of the profits that are made. Well, Madoff was giving them on top of that 4%. Well, Markopoulos's question was, why is he giving these people 4% except to make sure that they invest the money with him and to lock them in? And it later became argued, and I think correctly, and argued by Markopoulos as well as others, that the 4% was in effect a bribe to ensure, A, that people would invest the money with him, and B, that they would not look too closely at what he did, because it did not make economic sense for them to find out that something was wrong with what Madoff was doing and have to pull their money out because they'd lose that 4% that he was giving them and nobody else would give them. So there were...
It just seems preposterous to me that while that was going on, and everyone, I mean, most people are aware that you don't get 4% off the top of money that you bring, because he'd have to make that 4% plus so much more to break even on it. But at that very point, the government was still doing absolutely nothing.
That's
when it
right.
was becoming more and more apparent that this was ridiculous. And as you said, one accounting firm, etc. So unless you assume that the government was entirely asleep at the wheel, you have to assume that they wanted to be asleep at the wheel. Somebody wanted to be asleep at the wheel.
Well, that's my assumption. When Madoff began to enlist the feeder funds, That's when, according to Marco Polis, the thing really began to burgeon. Marco Polis's view, I don't remember how he derived it. I have read very closely his 17-page paper, but I don't remember how he derived his view, was that around the year 1999-2000, there was somewhere between $3 and $7 billion invested with Madoff. By the time Madoff blew up in the year 2008, there was, according to the government, $65 billion invested with Madoff, and it is widely accepted that the huge increase was a result of the feeder funds becoming involved. It is thought, nobody knows for sure, I don't even know that people could make good estimates, but there is an estimate that something like 50,000 people have been defrauded by Madoff, most of them through the feeder funds.
Could you describe those funds and what they are exactly?
Well, a feeder fund is nothing other than what is called a hedge fund. I don't know that they should be called hedge funds. I don't know that Madoff should be called a hedge fund, at least according to my understanding of what a hedge fund typically did. But that's no, never mind. They're called hedge funds. They promise to get outsized returns for people. They do that by using leverage, which is to say they will borrow money, or they will ask the investor to borrow money so that the investor or the fund is investing with Madoff. Not only the investors own money, but also borrowed money, which means that you can make more money when things go up, but you will lose very quickly all your money when things go down. The feeder funds were managed by people who claimed to be doing due diligence with Madoff, claimed in prospectuses and in meetings that they were very careful, that they examined everything very carefully, when in fact they were doing no such thing, and they were just taking in many millions of dollars, sometimes up to $6 and $7 billion, excuse me, and giving it to Madoff to invest. And you're quite right in saying that if Madoff was going to give these people 4%, that meant that he had to be doing pretty well. Well, what he really was doing was that he was making for his investors something on the order in the 1990s of 15 or 16% a year, so he said. During the 2000s, something on the order of 12% a year, or so he said. And to that, to whatever the figure was, you had to add the 4%. So in theory, had he actually been investing, which of course he was not, had he actually been investing, Madoff would have probably had to make, depending on the decade, either somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% or somewhere in the neighborhood of 16%. In order to accommodate the returns he was showing to investors and the 4% that he was giving to the feeder funds. Now, this didn't really seem crazy to most people, at least most people who understood, most non-professionals who understood his investment strategy, because the strategy was based on making continuous small gains. It was not based on huge big hits. It was not based on obtaining 40% per year returns, as really was the case for a lot of mutual funds in the 1990s, and as was the case then and subsequently right up until today, well, not today, until 2007, for a lot of hedge funds that weren't investing in Madoff. Madoff was, the epitome people thought of slow but sure, slow but steady. And he always made sure that he followed Warren Buffett's very well taken three rules of making money. And the three rules are, number one, don't lose money. Number two, don't lose money. And number three, don't lose money. And if you've ever been in a situation where this can come into play, you know that Warren Buffett is exactly right. So Madoff didn't lose money. I think he had only three or four allegedly losing months in the since 1990 or something like that. And the feeder fund people got their 4%, so they got hundreds and hundreds of millions in some cases over the years. And the investors were getting back what was not the kind of return they would get sometimes from other hedge funds or from mutual funds, but which was slow and steady and didn't lose money. And they accepted that in order to get this kind of a slow but steady return, they were going to have to pay taxes at ordinary income rates of roughly 35%. Whereas people who invested in feeder funds and the feeder fund manager, in hedge funds, true hedge funds, and the hedge fund managers who have made up to $2.5 billion in 1 year in one case. That same gentleman made something like $1.7 billion 3 years ago. These people pay taxes at the 15% capital gains rates. So the people who invested in Madoff, thinking that his operation was entirely legitimate, knew that they had to pay taxes at ordinary income rates of 35%, and they knew that their returns were going to be much lower than were being achieved by various mutual and hedge funds, but they accepted those things because they thought Madoff was a slow but steady and safe. So that's a sort of a longish answer to your question of what is a feeder fund.
I want to ask about the IRS, because you're talking about capital gains and taxes, et cetera. How did the IRS manage to ignore all of this for so long, never actually got involved?
Well, I can't really answer the question. I can tell you this. In 2004, for reasons that totally escaped me, the Internal Revenue Service appointed Madoff as one of 250 or 260 so-called approved non-bank custodians for IRAs. Now, that's important for several reasons. One, there are very few, non-bank custodians in the greater scheme of things. There's only an average of about 5 or 6 per state. In order to become a non-bank custodian for IRAs, which means that as a custodian, you keep the securities, you make sure they're there, basically, you're in charge of seeing that the securities exist and are available. As an approved non-bank custodian for IRAs, that's what Madoff was supposed to be doing. Now, this was all very peculiar I doubt that many people knew about it. I myself only found out about it within the last couple of weeks, and then I wrote I posted about this. Number one, Madoff said that he wasn't accepting IRAs. You had to go through something called FISR. Well, that turns out not to have been true, because we now know that at least some people had IRAs directly with Madoff. And, if people didn't have IRAs directly with Madoff instead of through FISR, why would Madoff have wanted anyway to become an approved non-bank custodian? And more importantly, to be an approved non-bank custodian, you have to meet various regulations which the IRS has laid down to ensure that the non-bank custodians are safe institutions for people's IRA securities to be located in. And among those regulations are ones which clearly could not have been met by Madoff, and which the IRA should have found, the IRS should have found out about. For example, you have to have your own trust department. You have to have your own vault. No owner of the company can own more than 50% of the company. Madoff had no trust department, and he owned, except for I think 10% that his brother owned, he owned the whole company pretty much. So there were these and other regulations which plainly were not met, yet in 2004, the IRS approved him as a non-bank custodian, even though had the IRS investigated, and it has claimed ever since 1984 that it has a right when approving companies as non-bank custodians to examine their books and records. That's important. It demanded the right, and publicly you said it had the right to investigate their books and records. Had the IRS done its job, it would have found out there's no trust department. Madoff owns the whole thing. There's no securities. I mean, the whole Ponzi scheme would have been blown out of the water, even though technically the IRS was only looking on behalf of IRA accounts. But, you know, the same thing that was true of IRA accounts, for example, no securities, would have been true. It would have found out is true of everybody. So, you know, why the IRS made Madoff an approved non-bank custodian absolutely escapes me. Now, people have said, and of course they're quite right, it's kind of a bitter statement, and yet it's exactly true, that the main beneficiary of Madoff's scam to date has been the Internal Revenue Service, which is by way of saying the United States government, because it has taken in billions, I don't know whether it's $20 billion or $50 billion, and the IRS isn't saying. It has taken in billions upon billions of dollars in taxes paid on Madoff income, which didn't exist. It's called phantom income. And every year, the IRS took in billions of dollars of this stuff. And now the IRS refuses to give most of it back, saying that various rules bar it, statutes of limitations on theft deductions, theft statutes of limitations against tax refunds, and so on and so forth. So the IRS, that is to say the United States government, having failed through to police Madoff via the SEC, having encouraged people to invest by its statements in 1992, having failed to stop Madoff when Markopoulos was begging it to act and giving it a roadmap for action in the 2000s, and having proved that Madoff as a non-bank, an approved non-bank custodian, now the IRS and the United States government, thank you very much, want to keep all the tax money that was fraudulent, that it's obtained via a fraud which it should have stopped as far back as 1992.
This would make a great Steven Spielberg film, would it not, or any other great director, of course, because it sounds like fiction. It almost sounds that there was a determination very early in the game that this is all going to play out just as it did. And it seems rather odd, and of course, again, just crazy speculation, that it all breaks apart at this time when everything else is collapsing around us, making it so much worse. What's your view of that?
Well, it's not surprising in a way that it broke apart at this time. Actually, you've asked two questions. You know, one question is, we're a bunch of people in cahoots here, in some way or other, in order to permit or ensure that this fraud would go forward and be successful for many years. My personal view is probably so, because there were just too many people who didn't do what their job descriptions entailed upon them. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. And that includes SEC people, IRS people, feeder fund managers, other persons who, being very sophisticated, hedge fund managers who got interviews with Bernie Madoff, decided because of his, what they call his lack of transparency when they asked him questions, that they were not going to get near him. And some of them even knew of peculiarities. This one hedge fund manager who I was talking about, who made $2.5 billion, I think, last year, or in 2007, and a few years before that made $1.7 billion, his firm knew that there were peculiarities in Michigan, at Michigan. That's where you and I went to school, right, at Madoff. And he never said anything. Half, you know, it's an exaggeration to say half of Wall Street suspected something was wrong with Madoff. There were many people on Wall Street who suspected this. Several of them have been quoted in the newspapers and have been quoted as saying they interviewed Madoff because they were thinking of investing with him, and they stayed away. Once they talked to him, they stayed away because they had the power to know what to look. They had the knowledge to know what to look for and the power to demand it for Madoff, who refused to give it to him. Whereas most investors, you know, the small people who are the vast majority of the however many thousands, maybe as many as 50,000, didn't have that same kind of power. So, you know, this one could say, yeah, that there was on some people's parts derelictions of duty, and other people's parts a conspiracy of silence. They may not have had a duty to report to the SEC or to report to the public, but there certainly was a conspiracy of silence. Now, why did it break apart now? Well, that's unfortunately very logical, and it's attributable to much the same thing that has caused the general economic meltdown, which has occurred since the middle of 2008. And that is that when the market started dropping like a rock, a lot of very wealthy people, and in particular hedge funds, I think it was one of the Fairfield funds that demanded $7 billion back from Madoff because its own investors, the fund's investors, were demanding their money back because they were worried about keeping money in the stock market. They wanted a flight to safety, as it is said, you know, treasury bonds, perhaps. These people were demanding their money from the feeder funds. The feeder funds were demanding the money from Madoff, and Madoff didn't have the money, and he couldn't raise new money. He couldn't raise enough new money. He tried, apparently. He even asked his buddy since 1960 or 62, Carl Shapiro, for hundreds of millions more, but that well went dry after a while. And Madoff recognized that, well, as you know, as occurs to inevitably in the long run to Ponzi scheme operators, people are demanding their money back, and you haven't got it, and so the game is up, and that's what happened. And you know, obviously, it was the drop in the stock market, the fact that everything went down like a rock, that caused people to demand their money back from Madoff. And caused the game to be up for Madoff because he couldn't deliver their money back. So the whole thing is quite logical, and the whole thing stems just like the Madoff thing stems, just like the entire market diminution or drop stems from the same basic kind of attitude. You had people on Wall Street, Madoff, Goldman Sachs. Merrill Lynch, the late Lehman Brothers, etc., as AIG. You had people on Wall Street who were ruled by only one thing, greed. That's all they cared about was money. That has been something that became a major philosophical basis of this country. If greed can be a philosophy by which to live, it became such a philosophy in this country. Among the Wall Street crowd, at least, and many others too, starting in 1981 when Ronald Reagan assumed office. That's beginning to be more widely recognized now. Some of us have been saying that for 15 or 20 years, and now it's becoming more widely recognized that the sainted Ronald Reagan was anything but. So greed rule, lack of regulation rule, the SEC didn't regulate, Federal Reserve Board didn't regulate, FINRA didn't regulate. I should say what FINRA is. FINRA is the Financial Institutions Regulatory Authority, I think is the official name. It's the successor to the NASD and the New York Stock Exchange Regulatory Arm. And it investigated Madoff every 2 years since 1962. Pardon me?
I said, oh, no. That's impossible.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Since 1962, when it was the NASD. And it was the NASD, as I say, until about 2005, 2006, when by federal statute, the New York Stock Exchange Regulatory Arm and the NASD were combined into FINRA. And FINRA never, though it investigated Madoff every 2 years, never found out what Demidov was doing. And FINRA, incidentally, when it was created for its first few years, was run by Mary Shapiro, who is now running the SEC. So, you know, there's been a complete failure. There's been a rise in greed to the point where it was the ruling philosophy of this country, if you ask me, and I think if you ask a lot of other people, too. There was complete failure and lack of regulation, and there may even have been deliberate complicity by regulators. So I think that's the story as to how a lot of this happened.
You mentioned in our prior communications the Security Investors Protection Corporation, the SIPC. Could you talk about that for a moment and its role in all of this?
Well, the Security Investors Protection Corporation was created by Congress in, I think, 1970. Its purpose was to provide a form of insurance for investors if their brokers went bust or committed fraud. And it started out, I think, the amount of the insurance was something like, I think, $100,000 worth of for securities and something like $20,000 worth for cash with the broker. By 1978, or in 1978, the money, insurance amounts were raised to $500,000 to cover securities and $100,000 to cover cash. And they have never been raised since then, although the inflation has, the cost of living has increased by approximately 350% since 1978. Now, the SIPC has a trustee who has been appointed to oversee the Madoff bankruptcy. I'm speaking generally here. This is the company's bankruptcy I'm talking about. And the trustee and acting on behalf of SIPC has said that people who the people will not get the $500,000 for securities if they took out money from Madoff, if they took out more than they put in. And that's an easy way to think about it. And that's something that is true of a huge number of people, because there are people currently in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, usually retired, who had, say, anywhere from $1 million to $1.5 million or $2 million in Madoff, and were using that to live. And over the course of 15 or 20 years, and it's certainly at least since they've been retired, they have been taking money out every year to the point where they have taken out more than they put in. They took out this money in order to live because they had no other income. This often represented their sole retirement income. So they took out the money to live every year and to pay their Madoff, their taxes on what was thought to be the Madoff income, because they had no other income with which to pay those taxes. And there are other people, by the way, who did something very similar. They took out income from what they thought was income from Madoff in order to pay their taxes every year. And because they did that, you know, they couldn't afford to pay their taxes from other income. They didn't have enough other income. And because they did that, they ultimately ended up taking out more from Madoff than they had put in. Well, the trustee's position is that he can go after these people to recover from them the money that they took out in excess of what they put in, and conceivably all money that they had in there. I mean, this is not quite sure in anybody's mind yet exactly what the trustee means. These are called clawbacks. This is a matter that, well, I'll put it bluntly, this is going to cause suicides if he does this, because you have people in their 70s and 80s who have no income on which to live. Zero. None. And now you want to claw back from them money they took out in good faith in order to live and to pay their taxes? Well, if the trustee does that, and nobody yet knows whether he will or he won't, as I say, I'm quite sure there will be suicides. I suspect.
Well, we just have about 5 minutes to go, but in these final 5 minutes, and this is the last 5 minutes have been riveting, I must say, to think about those people and what they must be going through right now. But just a few minutes, please, about yourself and what you went through when you discovered what had happened to you.
Well, I was, of course, shocked. When I first decided to invest in Madoff, I have never lived it. There are areas of this country, in southern Florida, in New York, in Minnesota, in Los Angeles, where there are large groups of Madoff investors. I've never lived in such an area. Washington became such an area after I left Washington in 1987. So I have never lived in an area having a lot of Madoff investors. I learned of Madoff, you might say fortuitously, you might even say freakishly, after a few years of hearing about him from a close friend, I asked a friend to ask Madoff whether I would be permitted to make an investment. You know, the theory was, it was pretty much a lie, although it wasn't wholly a lie, that the Madoff wouldn't take money from anybody and everybody, that you had to be a family member of previous investors, or you had to have some other reason for him to take your money. Anyhow, Madoff took my money, but before I invested, and despite the fact that I had been hearing for years of his continued success, I went up there to Madoff's offices, and I talked to his number two man, Frank DePascali, a name that's been in the news somewhat. He hasn't been indicted yet. I'll be very surprised if he doesn't come to no good end at the hands of the government. DePascali explained to me the investment strategy. It was one of those things which, being unfamiliar at that time, it was one of those things where you hear about it and you understand what's being said to you while it's being said, and 2 hours later you couldn't reproduce it to save your life. But I took very careful notes. And when I got out of there, I wrote out my notes are scrawled and scribbled. I wrote them out to make sense, and indeed, I have published them in a blog that I wrote, because I always kept them since 1995. Well, and then Madoff had done, so I had done what I could, and Madoff always did reasonably well. We always got statements every month. My accountant saw nothing wrong with the statements. I did know this other friend who would get statements, and there was nothing wrong with his statements or those of his family members. So everything appeared to be on the up and up until December 11th of 2008, when this friend called me and said, you know, don't start yelling and screaming, but Bernie, he talked to me at 5 o'clock, said that Bernie Madoff was arrested this morning for running a Ponzi scheme. Since then, I have spent a lot of time writing about it, doing research and various aspects of it. I was for a while, I have since resigned for various reasons, part of a group of about 300 people called Madoff Survivors, which is a Google website where people have come together to try to get something accomplished. Congress has not seemed to be very eager to act so far. Congressman Ackerman seems to be willing to put in a bill that would be very helpful to Madoff, to people who lost money with Madoff. The IRS's safe harbor provisions, the IRS came out with some guidance for theft deductions, as an effort to get some restitution to defrauded people. And when it came out with it, everybody applauded, just the way, things are always very popular when they first come out and people think salvation is at hand. It has become recognized more and more, as I wrote about a month or so ago, that the IRS's advice is excellent for people who lost hundreds and hundreds of millions and are so rich that the deductions will net them $100 million back. But for the average bloke who had $1 million or $2 million in and who was taking out money to live and to pay taxes, the IRS's guidance is going to do very little by way of good. So right now there's pretty much complete lack of transparency by the SEC, by CIPIC, by FINRA, by the IRS, by Congress people, the bankruptcy trustees, and people are ordinary people by the thousands. It's been paraded by the media as strictly a rich man's game. A game of hedge funds and of people who have $300 and $400 million or more. Not true. Not true. Ordinary people are involved and have lost their money, their homes, and their wherewithal by the thousands and maybe by the tens of thousands. So, I'm trying to do what I can. I am now personally, since I've resigned from this group, I am now personally undertaking to talk to people in Congress and their assistants about a particular plan that I have in mind that would help people a great deal and would pretty much lessen the amount of money by far that the government has to pay out for 7 or 8 years, or essentially until 10 years from now. I will let people know in a month or a month and a half what response I have been getting, good or bad. If I have been getting a good response, perhaps other people will want to participate. If I've been getting a bad response, well, nice try.
Well, this has been a riveting discussion. We're really talking high finance and high intrigue. At some level, it'll all come out in a few years, maybe sooner, I imagine. I guess you would agree about that.
Well, what can I say? Even the machinations behind the torture that this country has engaged in has been coming out. Even the machinations behind the Vietnam War ultimately came out. So in the long run, I guess most things do come out, although there's still questions about the Kennedy assassination. So I expect that in the long run, the pertinent facts as to how this happened, who did it, what, and when and why, will come out. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who, in the meanwhile, are going to be living in penury, because of what happened to them.
It's a very sad story, but I want to thank you for joining us today, Dean Belville, and it's been a pleasure to listen to you. So thank you again, and this is Dr. Joyce Starr with the Rights Radio Power Hour. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks, and please stay tuned. Bye-bye.